All right. Okay, shalom everybody. Before we begin, let me share the screen. So this way we can see the Daf Mekorot. And I see not everyone is on yet, but we can definitely begin. So the topic of the shir. I hope you all hear me. Welcome. And obviously, we are right now at Yom HaMiyuchas, right before the Shoshan Me'akbalah, right before the days where we're supposed to be preparing for Shavuot. So the Shir is obviously focused on Shavuot, on Chag HaShavuot. So I'd like to speak, to ask two different questions from two different arenas of Shavuot, and then connect them at the end of the Shir. The first question will be about the names of Chag HaShavuot in the Torah. And the second question will be from Megillat Rut. So, you know, if you ask anybody what Shavuot is, so the immediate reaction, a person will respond and say, well, Shavuot is the Torah. That's how we describe Shavuot in Shmoneh Esrei. We say it's Man Matan Torateinu, the time the Torah was given. However, if we look at the Torah itself, the Pshutei HaMikra, the simple reading of the Psukim, so there is no connection between Matan Torah and the names of Shavuot as written in the Torah. So, for example, if you go ahead and you look at the source, just one second, I just want to do one more thing. I'm sorry, I forgot. Give me 1 minute. I would just like to give me a second. I'm going to mute everybody. So this way, I know the stove will have background noise. Okay. So the So we have here is we have. So we want to discuss the names of Chag HaShavuot. So if we look at the Torah, place to look, we'll find, for example, look at source number one, which is really the first time the holiday of Shavuot is mentioned, even though Parshat Yitro is where the Seres and Divros are given and the experience of Shavuot is told about. However, when it comes to the names and the holiday, the first time it's mentioned is in Parshat Mishpatim. And there the Torah refers to Chag HaShavuot as Chag HaKotzir, the time of the harvest. And at that time, we are harvesting already the wheat, the barley. And as we know, that the Megillas Ruth revolves around that. If you look Chag HaKotzir and Bikuri Masecha, and the time of harvest, the time when you bring the Bikurim, and Rashi points out, what are the Bikurim? Bikurim are, Rashi says, the Shtei Halechem, Havoyim, this is the Shtei Halechem that we bring the korban of the two loaves of bread that we bring on Shavuot. That's also the first of the wheat that's brought to the Beit HaMikdash. Bikurim means the first, so that's the first. Sheshtei Halechem Vayim Matzeres Vayim Matir Nachadosh L'Manachot. What that means is that you weren't allowed to offer wheat from the new crop in the Beit HaMikdash until the Shtei HaLechem was brought on Shavuot. So therefore, since Bikurim refers to the new crop, the newest of the crop, for that reason, Shavuot, where the Shtei HaLechem is offered, the two loaves of bread from the new crop are offered, is referred to as the Chag HaBikurim. And then Rashi also adds in that is the time when people began to bring the Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash, that we know that someone who had in their field from the Zayin Minim Shenishtavchu Ben Eretz Yisrael, the seven species of fruit that Israel is praised by, would bring the Bikurim to the Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash. So the reason why it's referred to as Chag HaKotzir Bikurim Masecha is because it's a time of harvesting and because of the Shtei HaLechem and the Bikurim. However, the Rashbam points out that the reason in source number three, the reason why it's called a harvesting festival is because of the Shtei HaLechem, which was brought to two loaves of bread to allow you from then on to bring from the new crop of the wheat in the Beit HaMikdash. Not because of the Bikurim, the seven species of fruit that people would bring. And my father pointed out, the reason being is very difficult to connect Shavuos to the mitzvah of bringing the first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash. Why? Because the first fruits of the Beit HaMikdash were brought from Shavuot to Sukkot. And even after Sukkot could be brought, and it was not specific to Shavuot. It was just the beginning of the time when you bring the first fruits. So therefore, the Rashbam explains that the Purim here refers to the Shtei HaLechem, bringing the two loaves of bread. So we see the first time Shavuot is mentioned in the Torah, there is no connection in name at all to Matan Torah. Okay, just to the Shtei HaLechem, which is connected, again, to the Sefirat HaOmer. Source number four, the Parshas Kisisa. So it's referred to as Chag HaShavuot. And why is it called Chag HaShavuot? So ostensibly it's called Chag HaShavuot because we know in order to get to Chag to Zman Matan Torah Seinu, we have to count 7 weeks. For that reason, it's called Chag HaShavuot Taslo Chavikurek Sir Chitim. Again, so we connect the Sefirat HaOmer. We don't go ahead and we don't connect it at all to Zman Matan Torah Seinu. And then in Parshat Emor, where the mitzvah Sefirat HaOmer is discussed. So at that point, the Torah goes and says, Ukrasem the etzem ayom hazem, mikra kodesh yelachem, you should call on this very self-same day, mikra kodesh for you, komalach zavadol osasu. Again, actually a name is not given, but the essence of Shavuot is Sefirat HaOmer. It's either it's mentioned in the mitzvah of Sefirat HaOmer, or it's referred to by Shavuos, which is part of Sefirat HaOmer, or it's mentioned in reference to the Shtei HaLechem, which is the culmination of Sefirat HaOmer. So one of the questions I'd like to deal with is the question of why is it that we don't mention Zman Matan Torah Seinu, or more so, the question really is, why do we connect it to names? Why is Shavuos referred to as names? You connect it on some level to Sefirat HaOmer. Okay, so that's one question, which I hope to come back to and others to understand the name of Sefirat of Shavuot, why it's connected to Sefirat HaOmer and not necessarily to Zman Matan Torah Teinu. That's one question. The second question I want to deal with is the Megillas Rus. And that's in source number six. So we know the story of Megillas Rus, so just very quickly to go through the story of Megillas Rus. What happened was that Elimelech decided at a time of famine to leave the land of Israel. He left the land of Israel with his wife and his two kids, and he went to the Stei Moav, the fields of Moab. According to the way Chazal explaining it, they explained it, he abandoned the Jews in Eretz Israel. We know the tragedy that occurred, that Elimelech passed away. His two sons, it seems, according to the simple reading of the Psukim, intermarried, married Moabite girls, Machlon Vechilion. Again, they died. And after they died, Naomi decided, the wife of Elimelech, to go back to Eretz Israel. Her two daughter-in-laws wanted to follow her. And Naomi tried to convince them to return to Moab. Orpah listened. She turned her back. And Ruth did not listen. She followed her. And we know they came back to the land of Israel, poverty-stricken, and everyone understood and saw the misfortune that overtook Naomi. And it seems from the Psukim that Naomi was not able to pick herself up out of her despair. And only Ruth decided to go around and to look for, to try to scrounge together some food in order to support her and Naomi. And in the process of doing that, she bumped into Boaz, who was a relative of Elimelech. When Naomi heard that, and she heard how Boaz, her relative, responded and was helpful to Ruth, Naomi became very, very happy and it sort of picked up her spirit. She saw a glimmer of hope. And at that point, after some time, she told Ruth that Ruth has to be more proactive to create the shidduch. Okay, and without going into the story that happened in the third chapter, that's not the point of the shir, but basically Ruth went to see Boaz, and Boaz understood it's his job to help Ruth and to redeem Ruth. Now, what Ruth said to Boaz was that I want you to marry me, and this is in the third chapter, because you are the Goel. What does it mean you are the Goel? You are a relative of my father-in-law. My father-in-law's two sons passed away without descendants, and therefore it would seem it's your responsibility to do something to keep the family alive. And the best way to do it is in order to marry me. Because since I was married to my father-in-law's son, I'm the only one that's around. If you marry me on some levels, we'll explain a little bit later, you could somehow bring my father-in-law back in some way into this world. And Boaz heard Ruth, and Boaz was super impressed with Ruth. At that time, Boaz said to Ruth, wow, I'm amazed you came to me and didn't go to find a younger fellow. I'm going to take care of it in the morning, right away. But you should know that even though I am a goel, I am a relative, I do have a responsibility to marry you and to redeem the land that belonged to Elimelech that you want to sell and the Ami wants to sell. However, there is definitely a closer relative. And when it comes to redeeming land and marrying somebody in the family whose husband might have passed away without children, halacha is you go to the closest relative first. First, let me speak to him, and then we'll see what he says, and then we'll proceed. The next day, the next morning, Boaz, true to his word, went straight to the gate to meet people, to discuss with people, and Boaz goes ahead, and he finds his closer relative, who the Megillah refers to as Ploni Almoni, an unmentionable, we don't know his name. Obviously, he had his name, but for generations, his name was not known afterwards. In a certain sense, he was forgotten. Ploni Almoni was forgotten. We don't know. We don't know who he was. So he said to the Goel, do you want to redeem the land that Naomi is selling? Listen, Naomi needs to sell the land that belonged to Elimelech. And Ruth is going to sell the land that belonged to her husband. And do you want to redeem the land? And the lands go together. You have the first shot at it. And before I bought the land, I wanted to give you the first shot. And Ploni Almoni said, sure, why not? I will go ahead. I will buy that land. So let's look at Pasuk Gimel and see what happened in source number six. In source number six, in Pasuk Gimel, so what happened was, he said to the Goel, the person who's the closest relative. So the portion of the family land that was in the hands of Elimelech, Naomi wants to sell. So the question is, do you want to be the one to buy it? I said, before I buy it, I will reveal it to your ears. You should have the first action. I want you to buy it so everyone sees it. So it's clear. It's done. No questions. Everyone knows that you bought it. And if you're going to redeem it, yes. If not, tell me and I'll know what to do. You are the first one. But, you can't waste time. Okay, there's no procrastination here. Are you going to do it or not? And the Goel heard he had the opportunity to go ahead, to Ploni Almoni, to go ahead and to redeem the land. And he said, for sure, family land, but Yomer, no, I'll redeem it. So then in Pasuk Hey, Boaz says, hold on a second. But Yomer Boaz, when you buy the field from Naomi, the two fields go together. May Ace Rus Hanaviyah, he says, May Ace Rus Hamoviyah, Aces Hames Kenisi Lahakim Hashem Mes Al Anachlato. So you have to also buy the field of Ruth, and with buying the field of Ruth, you have to marry Ruth. Okay, why? So we'll explain why. In order to somehow bring back the mace, some remnant of the mace, which we'll explain in a few minutes. So all of a sudden, the Goel hears that in order to buy the land of Naomi, there are strings attached. He has to buy the land of Ruth also, which he could deal with. But he has to marry Rut. So that he's not going to do. I'm not going to go ahead and I'm not going to redeem the land because I'm afraid that I will destroy my Nachla. You go ahead and you redeem the land. So what really was the Ploni Almoni afraid of? Why didn't he want to marry Rut? So there are a few interpretations given. One interpretation was he was already married. He was afraid if he'd bring another wife into the picture, which was mutter in those days. He said, it would not be good for his family. So he didn't want to marry Ruth. Perfectly understandable. The second explanation was that even though they had discussed right there that Ruth was a Moabiyat and it's okay to marry a female Moabi, however, the bottom line was that Ruth was that he was concerned that even though the Psak Halacha was given that it's okay to marry a Moabite, however, who knows? Who really knows what would have happened if the generations later? It could be generations later, and it did happen generations later when David HaMelech was around. They might question the Yichus, whether anyone who comes from this union is a real Jew. And this is something which even when Rabbanim and Gedolim passed in a certain way, the Hamon Am will question the generations later. As an example, when the first Reish Galusa Bustanoi, the first Reish Galuta, so he was very friendly with the Caliph, and the Caliph married a Persian princess, and he wanted Bustanoi, a Jew, to marry his wife's sister. And Bustanoi did, and he had her converted to Judaism, and he had two wives. And over the course of generations, when there was a question of succession, there was always a machlokes between the two families, the family of the wife of Bustanoi, who was Jewish from birth, and the family of the convert, whether maybe the convert wasn't really a good convert. And obviously the other family would always question the Jewish status of those who descended from the wife of Bustanoi that converted to Judaism. And even though the Gaonim came out pe'ochad, that she was a kosher convert, she was a Gioris Tzedek, they still question it generations later. And the same thing happened here to Ploni Almoni. Said, I don't want to bring someone into my family that people might question the Yichus generations later. Panashkis is nachlosi. Okay, so that is a second shot. But I think there's a third shot. What was he really concerned about? Why couldn't he go ahead and marry Rus, bringing another wife into the marriage? It might have been somewhat common in those days. He was worried what would happen generations later to those children, but they would deal with that, and he had another family anyways. What was he really concerned about? The other question I want to ask, and I'll deal with that right now, is why is it that he tied together redeeming the land with marrying Ruth? It's the two halachos are unconnected. If I'm a lady, so it doesn't apply to me. But if I have a relative that sold the family land, the land which was given to my family, and after a certain time, the pasuk says, last week's parsha, I can redeem it. I have no obligation to marry a person from that family or the wife of the person that sold it if he had passed away. So why is it that Boaz connected to selling the land to marrying Ruth? So Rashi points out, he asked this question. In source number 7, Rashi says, Ata tzarech liknos, you have to acquire the land. Why? And he says, because you can't buy just Naomi's land. It's one field that has to be bought together. And Ruth had only agreed to sell the land to the person who marries her. Vehi eino nidratza, elin kainti se'ena. Ruth was very smart. She needed to get married. And she said, no, someone's going to buy the land. Do you want to buy the land? You have to marry me. It was more a practical suggestion. However, I believe the Malbim offers a different approach. And what does the Malbim say? So the Malbim points out that when the Ploni Almoni or Boaz was going to buy or acquire the land of Naomi, it was a very different acquisition from acquiring the land of Ruth. Why? Because the land of Naomi was, as Malbim says, liknot be'echad midarkei akniya, to buy it in one of the ways where you go ahead and you acquire land, that a person goes ahead and acquires a field. But what belongs to Ruth, that's a whole different story. That you acquire through Yibum. Yibum, what's Yibum? So Yibum we know is that when a person dies without children, so halacha is, his wife cannot get married to anybody, the brother of the person who passed away has to really marry her. It's called Yibum. And by doing that, they'll have a child. And by having a child, they will go ahead and they'll go ahead and somehow or another, that will bring on some level, some remnant or some, on the shaman to the world, that is influenced in some way by the person who passed away. That's called Yibum. So even though Boaz was not a brother-in-law of Ruth, but since Boaz was a relative of Ruth's husband, so he was able to fill Yibum in a certain sort of way, as we'll explain in a second. So therefore, the Malkin says the reason why he had to marry Ruth was because Ruth was only, this land had to be acquired through Yibum. It could not be acquired by the regular way of selling land. It had to be acquired through Yibum. That if Boaz would miyabim Ruth in a certain way, so then Boaz would be able to go ahead, then he would get the land. And the question is why? Why is that? Why do we say that he has to go ahead and he has to acquire the land on some level through Yibum? Why couldn't he just sell it? Why was it so important to acquire the land, the derech Yibum through Yibum, and not by one of the other darkei hakniya, the way you go ahead and you acquire it? So let's understand how Yibum works here. As I pointed out, Yibum in general applies when a person dies without children, the brother of the nifter, the brother of the person who passed away, marries the wife. Here we know that's not what happened. So let's try to explain what happened. So the first time Yibum is mentioned in the Torah, and that's actually before the mitzvah, is the story of Yehuda and Tamar. We know that Yehuda got married, and Yehuda had a child. He had three sons, and he married off his oldest son to Tamar. The first son, the oldest son, was not exactly the most righteous person in the world, and he died. And therefore, Yehuda told the second son, because of Yibum, who was the brother of the person who passed away, to marry Tamar, to do Yibum. And we know that the second son was also not so righteous and following the path, the footsteps of his brother. And for that reason, he died too. So therefore, Yehuda was faced with a dilemma, because really he should have given Tamar to the third child, but he felt maybe there's something wrong with Tamar, and therefore the third child will die also. For this reason, Yehuda was not as open with Tamar as he should have been. He was trying to procrastinate, push her off, and he says, listen, my youngest son is actually very young right now. I think you should wait around a while, and then later on when he grows up, he will marry you. After a while, we know that Tamar figured out what was going on, and Tamar dressed up like a prostitute, and this way she was able to be with Yehuda, and they had relations, and they had two children, and we know that Malchus Beis David came from Mepharet, one of those children. Okay, so that's the first case where Yehuda tried to do Yibum through his sons, didn't work, and the Ramban there explains what is Yibum. So you look at source number 9, the Yovanasava came Zara Lachicha, and Rashi there says, what you're going to do is, you're going to go ahead and you're going to name the first child after your brother. And Ramban says that's not true. Ain't it MS? Why? Because he said the bottom line is, by the mitzvah of Yibum, there's no halacha that you have to name the first child of the woman you're yadeh after the brother had passed away. There is no halacha like that. What a person has to do, he says, what's the halacha? He said, and the proof of the pudding is that Boaz was miyadim Rus, and he called their son Boaz. Did not call the son Machlo, right? So then the other thing is, we know, as we said, that in the pasuk there by Yehuda and Tamar, Yehuda's brother felt that the Zerah would not be his. Why wouldn't the Zerah be his? So what is the idea of Yibum? So if you look at the third paragraph of the Ramban says that Yibum is a very big secret. Avlinian so gadol bestowed a sefer tolos adam. He says Yibum is a very big secret, and he says it's very recognizable to the person that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave eyes to and ears to hear, that God gave eyes to see and ears to hear, and the Chachamim who came before the Matan Torah, like Yehuda. They know there's a great toelus, there's a great purpose in the brother marrying the wife of the brother that's deceased. And this is what should be. And the truth is that and he should be the one. He says that and anyone who can inherit the property of the one who's deceased can somehow or another can add to this idea of Yibum. Obviously, the closest relative is the best candidate, but anyone can somehow come together to accomplish this purpose. And for this reason, he said, back in his word, it was given when someone passed away. So it was the custom that
that the brother would marry the woman that whose husband passed away, or obviously went to the father or someone else. And then he says, I don't know if this is a custom before Yehuda, but it could be Yehuda was the first one to start it because he realized the secret. So what does that mean? In a certain sense, when a person is miyabed, the wife of the person who passed away
marries her, and he's a relative person who passed away, so he who somehow has certain attributes that are similar to the relative because they are in the same family, and he marries the wife of the person who passed away who also tried to go ahead. He also was influenced by her husband. Those two factors coming together can bring a soul in the world that is somehow similar to the soul that passed away. And in this way, you're leaving a remnant. You're somehow or another giving that the brother who passed away should have some continuity. That is the idea behind the Ramban Torah, the idea of Yibum, that someone other when a relative marries the wife, it's a secret of the person who passed away, somehow or another, you're able to bring into this world a soul similar to the soul that passed away. That's the idea of Yibum. It's a very hard concept to understand. And obviously it exists in the strongest way between a brother of the deceased and the wife of the deceased. And for this reason, the Torah allows the brother of the deceased to marry his sister-in-law, where the brother did not have children, in order to enable to be some continuity to the soul that passed away. But even when there is no brother, there is a possibility, and not an obligation, for a person to go ahead. And at that point, for a person to somehow bring some soul into the world that might be similar to the soul that passed away. And I think that this is the pshat, what Boaz was telling the Ploni Almoni. Says, Boaz said to the Ploni Almoni, listen, we have this land. Now, someone has to marry Rus. Not has to, but it's the proper thing. Why? Because by someone marrying Rus, they'll somehow allow a soul to come to this world that will somehow be similar to the soul of Mahlon. Somehow bring back the good attributes of Mahlon and the good attributes of Elimelech. And I could do that. But in order for me to do that, to accomplish it in the best possible manner, I also need to have the land of Elimelech and the land of Mahlon. I need to have that. It's true. You could take the land and I could marry Rus and I could accomplish it on some level. But in order to somehow bring a soul that is similar in the strongest way possible, it's not enough to marry Rus. We also have to land. And that's the proper thing to do. We're supposed to, from the Torah, somehow try to maneuver, manipulate, that we can bring a soul down similar to the soul of the person that passed away. So how are we going to do that? Someone has to, a relative should marry Rus. But in order to manipulate that the new soul that comes down, we also have to have the land that belonged to Mahlon and Elimelech. Why? Because it's not only important nature. Nature, our genes, is not the only thing that's important. Obviously, when we have a family, raise a family, nature is very important. And therefore, there might be in all of our genes certain attributes that are similar to our father, our mother, our grandparents. I have certain similar attributes, I hope, to my parents, to my grandparents. But what affects us is not just the attributes, but the nurture, where we're around, the environment that we're in. And therefore, it's important that I should connect on some level to the land. If I'm going to marry Rus, to the land of Elimelech had, the land that Mahlon had. So if I can marry Rus, and I am a relative, and Rus was influenced by her husband in some way, and I have the land where her husband and her father-in-law was, so nature and nurture come together and we can bring down a soul that will be very similar to that. And that's the reason why, along with selling the land, buying the land, Rus came along with that. Because and the person who had to marry Rus, the obligation, the challenge was Betoras Haso to somehow bring down on some level a neshama that was similar to the neshama of Machlon, attributes of Elimelech, and that would come about only, not only, but in the best possible way, through having the land that they connected to. And that's and the truth is, I think that that's the reason why it was connected. If we look, we go back.
Another question I asked, what was the plona only worry about?
Remember, I said, I don't mind buying the land, but Mary Rus,
I don't want to do that. Why? In source number 6, Pasuk Vav, Tarek Dala, Pasuk Vav.
What does it mean, Manachla? I have a heritage. I have certain ideas I've been building on, certain ideas that I've been working on, certain ideas that are very important to me, something I want to leave the world with. And if I bring down a soul that is similar to Machla and to Limelech and the good attributes, it's a different heritage. And I'm not willing to do that. And Boaz said, you know what? I am willing to do that. I'm willing to give up some of my ideas to somehow build a heritage which is similar to Elimelech, who, by the way, represented the idea of Malucha, Eli Malucha, and give up some of my ideas. That's what I want to do. And in order to do that, I need to marry Rus, and I need that land. And the Ploni Almoni agreed. What do we see from this? We see from this, and I think this is... I think quite clear.
And when we talk about bringing someone down to the world, as we all try to do,
what's important now, just point out, source number 11, he was successful. Because in source number 11, it says, Perek Dalet, but Tigren Elo Ashkenot, Shem Lemor, Yula Ben El Nami, Nami has a Ben. But Nami didn't have a Ben, Rus had a Ben. But the fact that Boaz, together with the land, with Rus, was able to bring his son in the world, it was very similar to the son of Naomi. The good attributes, the positive attributes. And that's what he wanted to accomplish. But that came through the genes and the land. Nature and nurture. What do we learn from this? We learn from this that when we're trying to raise children, and not just children, trying to raise students, we're trying to go ahead and improve the world and build the world. We have to take notice not only of nature, where we come from, but understand that nurture plays a very important role, such an important role. And anyone who ignores the nurture that's around us, the environment around us, is ignorant and is not dealing with life seriously. If you look at source number 12, the Sefer Hasidim, I heard this from my father many times. Source number 12, Yehuda Achasid, B'nei Adam Shemahalkim Be'eret, Limtzo Makom Lagor Sham. If you're going to a place, to find a place to live. So don't just look at the Jewish community. Look at the Goyim, the non-Jews. If the non-Jews are careful with arayas, with incest, respecting the privacy and the boundaries of a husband and wife, he says, you should know, da im yadur Yehudim v'osayir, gam v'nemes en yosim gyotim v'mgos magoyim. The Jews will be the same way. But if we deduce the opposite, if in that city, the non-Jews are not careful, there are no boundaries, and adulterous relationships are accepted, and incest is accepted, and all types of immorality is accepted, you should know it's going to affect the way a Jew looks at it. Because every city is similar to the non-Jews. And I remember my father saying, and this, by the way, is before the internet. I remember him saying it when I was a teenager, the 1980s. He would say, if Rabbi Yehuda Chassid could say that in the Middle Ages, Allah has come of a comma, how we are affected. But everyone that's around us, understand and appreciate nature and nurture, genes and nurture come together. And if we look around and we try to see what's going on in the world today, at the Jewish world today, and we see families that are struggling so much with children that are not necessarily following exactly or even the way they should be, going off a little bit. and we're bewildered. How did it happen? Such a long chain. We have to understand that the world today is a very scary place. And yes, we know it's a scary place because of missiles and everything that are going on. But in terms of the influence that's out there, we have to understand it's really scary. And that influence can be stronger. The nurture of the environment around us can be stronger than the nature, our genes, the great chain that we come from, the influence of Matan Torah. And we have to know what to do. But that was Boaz was clearly aware of that. And he was successful. So how do we counteract? Baruch Hashem, nature we have. We come from a great line. Mamlechus Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh. Great families. Every Jew has great yichus. How do we counteract the nurture of today? What do we do? It's a big challenge. But I was thinking of a certain idea that I think is very important. I asked the question, why is it that Shavuos, which is Man Matan Torah Teinu, is connected so much to Sefirah to Omer? Why? Why so much Sefirah to Omer? Shavuos, the Shtei Alechem, which is a culmination of Sefirah to Omer. My father explained that, you know, Sefirah to Omer starts off with a barley harvest, bringing a korban of barley to the Beit HaMikdash. A very small korban. That's very small. And we know that to count towards Shavuot, we count a day at a time. As a matter of fact, we don't say, we don't talk about how many days we have left. We talk about how many days we accomplished. 1 day, 2 days, 46 days. You know, we don't say, oh my gosh, we have 47 days till Shavuos. Why? Because we have to take in the small things. What's small? The barley, start with the barley harvest, something very small, and count day by day by day. Then, yes, by the way, once you finish a week, wow, we did a whole week. Same thing in terms of learning. A person should never say, oh my gosh, I've learned a whole masechta. Whether it's a half an amud, it's an amud, it's a daf, whatever it is, whatever you do. Small sacrifices all the time in terms of learning, in terms of chesed, small things. And then you accomplish something. Wow, Baruch Hashem, I do Amid Yomi, an Amid a day, 5 days a week. And that's what I accomplish. And I finish a perek. I finished a perek. It's great. But that's the way you work when it comes to Shavuos. He says a little bit now, then more and more and more and more. And that's Omer. If you look at source number 13, La'olam Alti'i Mitzvahs Omer. Don't go ahead and underestimate the power of Sefirah Omer, because through Sefirah Omer, Avraham Avinu was zoche to inherit Eretz Yisrael. He says, why? Because he says because Kadosh Baruch Hu said, follow my bris. So what's the bris? Mitzvah Omer. What is the bris of Avraham Avinu Mitzvah Omer? He says, And then Rish Lakish says through Mitzvah of Omer, we bring Shalom Bayis. Why? Because we know when a Sota goes to the Beit HaMikdash, she's accused of licentious behavior. She brings a korban very similar to the Omer, barley. What does it got to do with Mitzvah of Omer? My father pointed out, you want to acquire Eretz Yisrael? It has to be like the Omer. What do you mean it has to be like the Omer? Small sacrifices. Unfortunately, the sacrifices right now are not big, are not small sacrifices. But in general, living here, building the land, you know, dealing with hardships, those are small sacrifices. What's happening now is a big sacrifice. But we should get beyond that soon. Rish Lakish, you want to have Shalom Bayis? The mitzvah of Omer. Small things. Window open, closed. Be nice, you know, try to help out. Sefirah Omer represents doing small things. So do you want to know why it is that Shavuos is not referred to as Man Matan Torah Seinu? It's referred to in the Torah as holidays that connect to Sefirah Omer, whether it's Chag HaShavuot, counting the weeks, whether it's for the Shtei HaLechem, which is the culmination of small sacrifices. It's because if you want to acquire Torah, we have to realize there are small sacrifices that are involved. And you have to do small things all the time. That is the way, I think, one of the ways, I say, to counteract and to stand up against the nurture of today, the environment of today, to stand up. What does it mean? We have to convince and realize and appreciate how every small thing can do something. If you look at source number 14, the Rambam in the Geret Teman, the Rambam Geret Teman says, "Lo yala ladas shebiyota osa hamurot shayona kalos." If someone does big averus, he won't be punished for the small averus. Kedei shiyakras. The person says, "Listen, I did big averus, so why can I do small averus also? Do whatever I want." Abu Yeravam ben Avot, Ravam ben Avot, who was involved in crushing bones, and he's going to be punished for avodah zarah. I'm sorry, he says, Ravam ben Avot, who caused so much damage, and he will be punished for putting up idols in Eretz Yisrael and causing Jews as a whole to worship idols. And he was a Machdi as Yisrael. He will be punished for not doing the mitzvah sukkah. Everyone is held responsible for every sin that they do. And even if they don't go ahead and do a certain mitzvah. In Parshas Ekev, source number 15, Kol ha-mitzvah asher anochi mitzavcho ayom tishmurum la'asos. All the mitzvah that I help command you to do, you should do. What's kol ha-mitzvah? It's kol ha-mitzvot. All the mitzvot. The Derech HaMelech, which is a compilation of the Torah that the Piazechner Rebbe, Hashem Yinkam Damo, who was killed during the Holocaust, said during Sudash Lishit on Shabbat, says, you know kol ha-mitzvah? Why is they kol ha-mitzvot? Because you never know which mitzvah is to connect a person. Which mitzvah is going to bring a person back. And that's why the Rambam says that Yeravam Nevot, if he had done sukkah, it could have brought him back. You never know what it can do. Every mitzvah is so important because every mitzvah can bring you back. And any mitzvah besides bringing back can connect you. And that's Chag HaShavuos. The small things. Don't ignore the small things. Every small thing is important. I want to share with you a story, a very beautiful story. When I was growing up in Chicago, my father had a doctor. I'm not going to say his name. I don't know who's listening. This goes back to the 70s, who his grandchildren might be. And it was a family whose the doctor's father was a European Rav. As a matter of fact, this European Rav gave a hesped for Reb Chaim, when Reb Chaim died. My mother visited his almana. She was able to tell over to my mother the hesped her husband gave for Reb Chaim Brisker. And this man, this Rav, had five sons. Three of the sons were gifted, very bright. And two of the sons were, regular. So three of the sons were so bright. They were very involved in learning. They went to Lakewood. And one of the sons, I know for sure, the two sons were religious, but one of the sons that was religious actually, as a young man, became irreligious and went off. The three sons who went to Lakewood afterwards went to university, became very successful. One was a doctor, one was a lawyer, and one was, I think maybe a judge, I'm not sure. And they became irreligious at some point. And then you had the one who became religious as a young man, maybe in high school, post-high school, he was a blue-collar worker. And when the father died, so I guess they all knew, in those days, a parent passes away, you have to say Kaddish. I saw many stories of this, 70s, 80s, the 90s. So he went to shul every day. And of course, he went to Orthodox shul, went to Lubavitcher shul. And he used to say Kaddish. Then after he finished davening on the way to work, he would stop off at the restaurant, I think on Peterson and Kimball, and buy for breakfast bacon and eggs. Okay. And he wasn't religious. And somehow or another, he felt that there was something wrong. It didn't feel right. Because How can you say Kaddish and go eat bacon and eggs? So he went to speak to the rabbi. As I heard the story, the rabbi was a Rav Hecht. It's Lubavitcher name. He was the Rav. And you know, he says, you know, Rabbi, he says, I'm sure he spoke in Yiddish. Maybe he didn't. He says, I don't feel right about myself. I say Kaddish and then I eat bacon and eggs. No, so my response would have been, I think, oh, well, maybe you should eat bacon and eggs. Rav Hecht was a very smart rabbi. He says, oh my gosh. He says, it's horrible. I think we have to make you feel better. I think you should wear tzitzis. Put on tzitzis. So he went ahead, he put on tzitzis, and after a week he came back and said to Rabbi Hecht, he says, I'm still not feeling good about this. I even feel worse. So slowly but surely, he gave him another mitzvah, another mitzvah, another mitzvah. And at some point, this person became religious again, and he felt good about himself. Every mitzvah, everything can accomplish. You know, my kids know that personally for me, every mitzvah is important. Whether it's a question, of course, of Shabbos, tzitzis, tefillin, not eating before davening, whether it's a question of any halacha is halacha. They know. And I was thinking this week, maybe today, why is it so important to me? Why is every halacha important? Because I think kol ha-mitzvah, every small thing, you never know which small thing will connect you to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kol ha-mitzvah. And there are boys I know in the neighborhood who went through times that were very challenging, but they had red lines. One boy, I'm not sure what he did on Shabbos, but he never missed a day of tefillin. And that kept him connected. And maybe the message is, yes, we live in very challenging times. We live in times where the nurture, the environment around us is scary, overpowering, overbearing. And somehow or another, it stands up against the nature, against the genetics, against our beautiful heritage of Judaism that we have generation to generation. And what's the message we can give? In a positive way, every mitzvah the generation can do is so important, because every mitzvah connects us, and you don't know which mitzvah is going to bring them back. There are so many, so many stories of people who were connected in some way, and they came back. So many, so many stories. And that's maybe the reason why the Torah does not say Zman Matan Torah Seinu. The Torah talks in the names of Zman Matan Torah Seinu, Shavuos, connects it to the Shtei Alechem, to remind us that what's in the name of Shavuos, how do you understand the essence of Zman Matan Torah Seinu? Realizing the small things, the small sacrifices. And I think that we have to, in a positive way, we have to emphasize how important every mitzvah is. That's why halacha is so important, because everything is so important. And if there are people who, there's certain things they keep, certain things they don't keep. Sometimes you tend to look and say, wow, how can this happen? Positivity. It's so important. Every single thing is so important. It's, you know, and to realize, because that's the key. That's the key. And that's why, you know, there's an interesting Gemara Maseches Menachos about a certain person who did not act in a very appropriate manner, very licentious. And the Gemara tells his tzitzis saved him. And tzitzis hit him in the face. He was about to be intimate with a prostitute. It's the idea of, for him, the tzitzis connected him. And that's what we don't know what's going to help us, what's going to do it for us. That's why every single mitzvah, and even the prat of the mitzvah are so important. And for those who are being challenged to realize, wow, Baruch Hashem, they're keeping that mitzvah. Whether it's Hadlakas Neris on Shabbos, or it's Kiddush, or it's putting on tefillin, or it's kosher, or, you know, whatever it is. It's talis. It's davening. Every single prat is so important. And that's why Shavuos, the name of Shavuos, emphasizes the goal, after small actions, counting the weeks, the full 49 days. And I think that we should keep in mind for ourselves also, as we come to Zman Matan Torah Seinu, is to keep in mind for ourselves also, how if we focus for ourselves on small goals and ourselves to improve ourselves, that will definitely have an effect. Because whatever we do affects the world. In last week's parsha, I'll finish with this. Parsha's Bechukosa in the Brachot, it says, you know, five will chase 100, and 100 Jews will chase. And it doesn't work out. Five between 100 and 110,000 doesn't work out, the equation. But Tfasama says, when five chase 100, they have a tremendous influence on the world around them, and other people will get involved and have a koach. In regard to mitzvahs also. So yes, on one level, appreciate when someone and push and inspire whatever they're going to do. Everything is so important. And the second level, for us, in order to prepare for Matan Torah, let's take something upon ourselves, something small, to bring us closer to Hashem. And hopefully, besides influence the world around us, by somehow or another standing up against the nurture of the environment, will be a schus for the Jews all over, especially for Jews in Eretz Yisrael. And we should be zochet to see Refuah and see Yeshua. We should zochet to very, very good things. And we should be able, as the Rambam says, to serve Hashem without worrying what the Ummah Olas will do. Everyone should have a wonderful Shabbos and a Chag Sameach.